Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
My new book, Diary of a Psychosis, is out. It's the most lively, devastating baseball bat to the throat takedown of what the public health establishment did in 2020 and beyond that you can imagine. It's my first book in 9 years, and you're going to love it. Check it out at diaryofcovid.com. And if you've already bought it, make sure also to visit diaryofcovid.com so you can claim your free bonuses, including my free companion volume, Collateral Damage, a collection of stories from real people who suffered under the restrictions. They weren't allowed to tell their stories at the time, but every one of them told me, "We just want to be heard." Check it all out at diaryofcovid.com. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Tom Woods Show. It's episode 2440. And if you believe Gene Epstein, he's been on about 2,312 of them. No, that's not true. But you did do a percentage breakdown at one point that I thought was
funny. I computed the numbers wrong. My denominator was, I've been on, it's like 48 times. And because I'm greatly honored to be that high in number. But look, you have so many other wonderful guests.
Thank you.
A competition. They're not competitive products. They're complementary products.
Complementary, absolutely.
Fascinating concept in economics I'll lecture you on that some other day. Anyway.
Well, I could go into Gene's background. I'll just tell you that right now, he is director of the Soho Forum, which is a tremendous debate society series in New York that covers topics of interest to libertarians and human beings in general. And today, of course, we're going to start with our usual banter. So if you're new to the Tom Woods Show and you're new to the Gene Epstein episodes, if you get impatient with this, you can always just, as they say in the old days, fast forward. But if you like Gene, which you should because he's a libertarian hero, and he's been around for so long doing so many good things, you're going to enjoy our little opening banter. We talk about what's going on in the world. But then we're going to talk about, why don't we first, so as to sustain them through the banter, why don't we tell them, Gene, what they can look forward to in the episode?
I'm going to rehearse with you a little talk that I'm planning to deliver this coming Saturday at the Libertarian Convention. Luncheon speaker is what I'll be, Libertarian Convention in Jacksonville, Florida. And in that case, I want to do an exercise where I say, in line with what David Friedman has argued, that really you should be able to convince a rock-ribbed left-wing progressive of the virtues of the free market without resorting to freedom and the non-aggression principle, that all the objectives that they like can be best realized through the free market. So it's going to be kind of an intellectual discipline, and you're going to help me with it because I hear you are one of the greatest speakers in the world coaching me. So I'm incredibly honored that you're doing this, Tom, and that you're doing it on air, and you're going to make me better. Because as you've said many times, everyone in the audience is pulling for you when you deliver a speech.
Right.
As I've always pointed out, yes, except when you're debating before the Soho Forum.
Right, then they're not all pulling for you.
There you've got somebody on stage contradicting you and some people in the audience with their knives out for you. But that won't be the case for me this coming Saturday, and that's why I'm on it. So again, it's going to be an interesting discipline. If you were a progressive, which I used to be, then you should be supporting the free market just as much as we people who are libertarians do, since, of course, for us, freedom and liberty also matter. So
Right. Yeah,
that's going to be the point. And of course, if you want to skip that part, guys, and just stick with the banter, you could always do that.
You could do that. You could just turn it off as soon as we go to that.
Go back into the substance. But the point is that just a little banter is how honored I am to be talking to you, especially on a day like this, Tom. Not long ago, I finished reading a great book called The Diary of a Psychosis, and I blurbed it, but I probably should have just done the cliche blurb, which is that if you read only one book about the lockdowns, this should be the book, unless possibly you're a specialist epidemiologist. But for 99% of us, the vast majority of us, this is a book by an everyman. A smart everyman who had the time to follow what was going on, but it's written for us. It's how you can become increasingly aware from early on, could have become increasingly aware from early on, how we were in the midst of a mass Psychosis. And it's a collection of pieces. I guess, is it verbatim, Tom? You edited so much. It's a collection, actually, of what you wrote, but you did some editing in order to...
Yeah, here and there. And I had, some things were kind of out of date or whatever. And I had, and also, if I had published the entirety of everything I had written, Gene, it would have been 250,000 words. And that's just not reasonable.
Amazing. Well, anyway, unless you're, unless you're 7 years old, you remember what happened early on. I lived through it. I had my own experience. But this is a way for me to live through it once again and be accompanying somebody who had a little bit more time and maybe a little bit more smarts to begin to understand what was going on in terms of being a psychosis. So it's kind of a private diary for us all. And of course, written in Tom's usually lucid prose, any chart or graph he presents is very presentable. It's a picture that's worth 1,000 words. So again, I return to the cliche quote, if you read no other book about the lockdowns, this is a book to read. And I've been wanting to re-experience the book because I knew that you'd done an Audible version. And I keep going on Amazon looking for the Audible version. Mm-hmm. And my immediate reaction is, did your publisher, antiwar.com, Scott Horton,
a Libertarian Institute. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, Libertarian. Okay. He's a Libertarian Institute. Sorry, that's right. Okay. Did Scott Horton screw up? And you wrote me just the other day, no, it's not Scott's fault. And you said you would reveal the problem that apparently has been solved. Could you go into that for my benefit?
All right. So the company you use, if you want to get Audible to run to have your audiobook for sale and you're self-published, which, the Libertarian Institute is a publisher, but it's not quite a traditional publisher. So I just took care of the audiobook myself. I've done it before.
Yeah.
And you use a company called ACX. And ACX is notorious for being arbitrary in how long it takes to get your audiobook up. Well, this was taking an inordinate amount of time. So I finally wrote to them and they said, oh, there was a problem. Were you going to tell me? Here's the problem, Gene. Now, you know that the book is a whole bunch of extremely short chapters, like really short. So if you were to count them up, there's like 240 of them. And the problem was when I submitted them in order, chapter 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But when I got to 238, the next one I uploaded was 240, and the one after that was 239. And they said, you got to flip those. Now, it would have taken them a second and a half to flip those. So I went back into my account, I flipped them, I resubmitted it, and now it's the usual, 10-day wait period. That was the problem, Gene.
So you mean, that is...
Yeah.
It was your mistake, Tom. You actually...
It was indeed my mistake. But you would think they would, number one, tell me. And number two, it is such a trivial and easily corrected mistake. It's incredible that they actually tossed it back to me. But I do appreciate your kind words. Of course, I want to remind people, if you listen to this show and you don't have this book, I don't understand you. I haven't written a book in 9 years, 10 now. So, I finally do it. If you don't get it, I ain't doing this no more. So,
that is rather funny because the only irony of that is that oftentimes you get rather heavy-handed editing from anybody who publishes whatever you do.
Yeah.
And they not only, this is a capitalist company. This is sort of indicts my case for capitalism. You're saying that they couldn't even inform you. They just basically sat on it.
And they waited for me to ask them where it was all going.
Wow.
So will be out soon.
But let me further say that Tom read another book called Contra Krugman, written by a mutual friend of ours. And you are a very good reader,
Thank you.
One might imagine you could be, but not everybody is. And it's pretty effortless for you, right? Because I know it comes out right, right?
It's so time-consuming. Recording an audiobook is one of the worst things you could possibly do. But as you say, it will be in my voice, so you'll hear my inflection, you'll hear my emphasis, you'll hear my sarcasm, my contempt is way better than just some guy they hired because these are my words. I know where the emphasis belongs. I know where the contempt belongs.
That's right. I want people to know that Tom could have had a successful acting career had he wanted to go in another direction. And so that's another reason to really appreciate his ability and understand that you should do it all. Read it and listen to it. because those are two different experiences. I very much look forward to listening to the audible book, even though I read the superb book. But on top of that, of course, when you talk about the 9 years since you wrote a book, I found that today we are recording this on Martin Luther King Day, and I resurrected a tweet I'd written a couple of years ago, quoting from a chapter in one of your books called 33 Questions About American History You're Not Supposed to Ask. And it is a chapter on Martin Luther King and what he really felt about affirmative action. And I think it's a respectful chapter. You don't condemn the man. You just place him in proper context. I can't help admiring him in other ways. But I think that your chapter in that book is really worth reading, because the content of your character's statement that he made famous is really worth quoting. Not be judged by the color of your skin, but by the content of your character. It's a great alliterative phrase. And as you point out, King was for affirmative action in particular and had strong socialist leanings. And so he betrayed his own principle, but that doesn't diminish the fact that he was an admirable guy. But anyway, also, I looked through that book. I really think it's one of your best books, Tom.
Happy with that book, Gene. And it's incredible. That book came out in 2007. It's 17 years old. But 33. I don't make one extra dime on that book because I got such a big advance. I never cleared it in the sales. So I'll never see another dollar for that book. But I love it. I'm so proud of that book. Everything except the stupid, dumb title. 33 Questions About American History You're Not Supposed to Ask is a bad title. If I had better friends at the time, Gene, they would have intervened. They would have had an intervention and said, you cannot release this book under that title.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah, I got a tweet from an admirer when I listed this book in my tweet this morning. I didn't realize what joke he was getting at. He said that you have to get to the third page to finish reading the title. And I just sort of stupidly thought, what? I don't know. That's such a long time.
Well, look, as we wrap up this part.
What were you calling it? Tom, you got a better title now?
No, I didn't. That was why I went with that. I did not have a better title.
Tom, you've had a lot of years to think about it, and you still haven't been able to come up with a better title.
Well, the thing that happened was the Politically Incorrect Guide to American History had come out at the end of 2004, and that did extremely well. And so then I got a literary representation, and this agent said, well, you have to write another book. And I thought, what? Why? And he said, how do you not understand this? You're hot right now. You had a bestseller. It was a bestseller for 12 weeks, New York Times. You got to have another book. So go ahead. Well, so what is it? So I had to come up with something. And I thought, I have a lot to say. Well, you know what it was, Gene? I have a little to say about a lot of things. So I did this 33 Questions book. And so he chopped it around as an agent does. And one publisher after another, they were in a bidding war to see who could get this book, who would give me the bigger advance. So I ended up getting a very, very handsome advance. Now, they didn't lose money on the book. They still did very well. I just didn't, I'm not going to be getting any further royalties on it.
But I see.
I have to, before I let you talk any further, say as we wrap up the book discussion, the website to go to is diaryofcovid.com because that's... You see the endorsements for the book. You see the incredible book video. It is incredible. That blows me away every day. It gives me the chills every time I see it. And it also lists the two bonus books you get. And you can, if you bought the book 3 weeks ago somewhere or some friend gave it to you, still go to diaryofcovid.com and claim your bonuses because you get some really nice goodies. All right, let's talk about...
I should do that. But you still haven't... Give me a better title for that book. Let me just do a couple of plugs. You're going to prepare me for a talk that I'm going to be delivering this coming Saturday. I was asked to be a gray eminence at the Florida Libertarian Convention, and they wrote me back so gratefully, really made our day. They probably asked you first, Tom, if you would be the gray eminence, and asked others. I'm a B-list libertarian and very happy to be so because I have like 1/10 the trolls that you have, as an A-list libertarian. I think sometimes you wish you were a B-list libertarian because you didn't get targeted. You'd get targeted a lot less often. But that aside, they asked me to go down and I said, well, I've got to bring my wife. Yeah, we'll pay for your wife. So it's going to be at the South Bank Hotel Riverwalk starting Friday evening and into Saturday. I guess I'm uniquely equipped because I'm a Soul Forum director to be moderating the debate between the six presidential candidates. And that will be one of the main events that evening on Saturday evening. And I've set time and limits and structure for it. And they're very pleased by that.
But then I'm going to interrupt. I'm going to give you some advice to make that more interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Because they just did a debate like that at the Georgia Libertarian Party convention. And what happened was they all basically just spoke to the audience and they didn't, there was no cross, almost nothing. There was nobody attacking the other one. And look, you know, they're not going to get any attention to the mainstream media. No one's going to engage with them one way or another. Can't they at least engage with themselves? So you generate a little bit more heat out of them, because this is going to be a yawning festival if you don't get them to talk to each other and let's tease out who's wrong, who's right, who's libertarian. I mean, you know, come on, that's what I want to see in a debate, not a bunch of speeches.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, in the matter, I wrote them some protocols, and I guess it's not too late to change the protocol. They'll have several days. You think that I should encourage them to ask each other questions to give a lot of time?
They should interact with each other. Otherwise, they all just look like boring stuffed shirts. They really, you know, because, you know, I have more libertarian principles than you have. But no, you know what? If they did that, that would be more interesting.
Yeah.
Then when I was told about the Georgia one, oh my gosh. I mean, we got to, like, you don't want to have to give everybody 10 cups of coffee during the debate. It should be exciting.
All right. I got to ponder that one.
You got to think about that one, Gene. They will remember your debate. They'll remember your debate if you do it that
way. Yeah, no. I always do one-on-one debates at my Soul Forum.
Yeah.
And so there's always a half hour allotted for crosstalk and for contradicting each other. And in fact, the recent debate with Jay Bhattacharya, we issued certain excerpts where they were clashing with each other very directly. And I guess that's the liveliest part. And so I've got to rethink that. And thank you very much for the very good advice. Because a six-person debate is unprecedented for me, so I probably didn't give it enough thought. So thanks for that advice, which I will follow. So you're going to help me rehearse for that particular luncheon talk that I'm going to deliver. I just wanted to mention as well that I invite people to come to the Soul Forum on January 29th, and there will be a debate with Terence Keeley. And Terence Keeley is the author of The Economic Laws of Scientific Research. He was a guest on your show about, 6 weeks ago by now. And I recommend that people listen to that interview and then recognize that clearly a whole lot of people disagree with Terence Keeley. That's again Monday, January 29th. And so he's going to have to subject his views to criticism from a very smart guy from the American Enterprise Institute. And come for that weekend if you're out of town. I know that the play that goes wrong and Peter Pan that goes wrong, not playing anymore. But Spamalot is a very good show. Have you seen it, Spamalot?
I haven't, but I'm pretty sure a play that goes wrong is still going. It's Peter Pan that was only a limited engagement.
I looked it up, Tom. Okay, maybe into the research. I looked it up at the theater, and they seem to say they're on tour. But look it up. Play that goes wrong could be playing. I saw Spamalot in London, and I was really very pleasantly surprised by what a great show it is. And it's been revived on Broadway. So if not the play that goes wrong, see Spamalot Sunday afternoon matinee. You know, make a weekend of it if you're coming in from out of town, because then Monday evening, the 29th, is the Soul Forum debate. So that's my main plug. Although, of course, my God, we're talking about matters relating to Tom. What Tom is going to attend in the audience, my February debate, which is going to be about Israel-Palestine. And then on top of that, Tom is going to be one of my two debaters in April. So if you go on thesoulforum.org, you can see all of those debates listed and tickets on sale. We have reduced our prices by 20%, in part and mainly, in fact, because we actually more than succeeded in raising money at our fundraising in November and December. And so we're passing some of that savings on. A legitimate price decline, a price deflation, 20% off our usual price, which is already pretty cheap. So thank you very much for allowing me to make that plug, Tom. And now I guess I should get into the main subject of what we were going to discuss.
Which I think so. I think this is a record, Jen. I think we're almost 20 minutes in.
Oh my God.
I sure hope people enjoy the banter because they sure got a lot of it.
You're part of the blame for that time. You did.
Yeah, I am. But also they learned some things. We talked about some real things, publishing and all that. Hey, everybody, a quick message from our sponsor, Blinkist. Christmas 2023 has come and gone, and something tells me your friends and family once again fed your book addiction. You and I have far more books than we can possibly read. And as I've said before, by the time you and I finish one book, chances are we've already purchased two or three more. And don't pretend that isn't you, dear listener. I know you better than you know yourself. Well, the Blinkist app can help. With Blinkist, you can absorb huge amounts of information, the kind that satisfies your natural curiosity, as well as the kind that will help you be more successful in business and in life. We're talking 27 nonfiction categories, and Blinkist condenses each book into 15-minute summaries you can read or listen to. And for some books, you'll say, I got to go out and read the whole thing. And for others, you'll say, maybe this was plenty. So if you have a half-hour commute each way, you can absorb the equivalent of 4 books. You think that might make you a more impressive person? You'll even find libertarian classics from Murray Rothbard, Milton Friedman, and dare I say, even Woods, your very own host here. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/Woods to start your 7-day free trial and get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/Woods to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/Woods. And now for a limited time, you can even use Blinkist Connect to share your premium account. You'll get 2 premium subscriptions for the price of 1. All right, so what's your approach? You're going to give this talk. So the idea is you're treating the audience as if they are a hypothetical progressive.
That's right, yes.
And what you would say to that person who is very skeptical of the economics of Gene Epstein.
Well, but also basically indifferent. I will tell you this tale because, in fact, it was retained in the recording. I did an interview with Rob Bernstein just a little over a week ago, who is a partner to Dave Smith on the part of the problem. Rob does a show called Run Your Mouth, and he told me that he listened to the debate I had with David Friedman. David is actually, I'm going to pretend to be David Friedman in one sense. David is an extremist. David argued that the zero or non-aggression principle, the freedom principle, is really unsustainable, and that consequentialism is really the only argument we have. I debated David, but interestingly, Rob told me that he's a consequentialist. Rob said, I've never been turned on by the freedom or non-aggression issue. I'm a libertarian because of the consequences. And so that surprised me. And indeed, I think that there are more and more people we could possibly bring in. If you want to be a libertarian because the free market squares most directly with your progressive principles, then of course, we invite you in. We need all the help we can get. And so that's part of the argument, part of the idea. And of course, on top of that, autobiographically, I came from that tradition. I was a socialist until my late 20s, basically. And then I read Man, Economy, and State, the Murray Rothbard book. And that really consequentially turned me onto libertarianism before I became a full-blown libertarian. But I have a number of note cards. I'm sure there won't be enough time for me to go through all of the points that I want to stress. Oddly, I want to begin with the Scandinavian argument. Now, Milton Friedman once told me, among my many conversations with him, that intellectual progress has been signified by the fact the socialists are no longer pointing to the Soviet Union or any of the communist states as their exemplars. Now they just talk about Sweden or Scandinavian countries generally. That's now their brand of socialism. Now, we still have to occasionally point out to the progressives that we did have 2 controlled experiments, East Germany versus West Germany, North Korea versus South Korea. You know, basically the same country, you cut it in half, and one goes socialist, the other goes primarily capitalist, and then you see the results. And that should be reasonably persuasive. But then they play the Scandinavian card, which is that, of course, they may even concede the point I constantly make that all of these Scandinavian countries do have stock markets. You know, and if a country has a stock market, where they're trying to maximize profits to get their share prices higher. And it definitely is capitalist to a great degree. It's also true, by the way, that if you look at the Economic Freedom Index of the Fraser Institute / Cato, they have five criteria for economic freedom. And the only way in which the Scandinavian countries have less economic freedom has to do with the government's role, the government's share of the economy and the welfare state. According to the other four criteria, especially rule of law, the Scandinavian countries actually come out somewhat better than the U.S. And so that's another indication. But what is their point then? What the point best stated is that, well, you can keep capitalism, but why not have the kind of a very extensive welfare state that you have in Scandinavia? That's the really main progressive argument put in its best terms. And the first thing to fall back on is Milton Friedman's quip, perhaps apocryphal, but I think he said it in one context. I think he was told, we have no poverty in Sweden, by his Swedish host, and he responded by saying, that's interesting, we have no poverty among Swedish Americans either. And of course, what Friedman was pointing out is that, in which a point that's been made a number of times, that Germany included, by the way, if you actually compare the standard of living of Scandinavian Americans with Scandinavians in Scandinavia, or German Americans, in fact, you find that their standard of living in the U.S. is somewhat better. And therefore, culture is a very crucial determinant of outcomes. That was a crucial point to make. But I want to add one other point, which I think is also, it was just as important, which is that the Scandinavian model is not limited to Scandinavia. It's also pretty extensive across Europe. It's just not called the Scandinavian model because it fails so badly. Countries like Portugal, Spain, Greece, and Italy have pretty much the same thing, mainly capitalist countries, but in line with a very extensive welfare state with nationalized healthcare. And why aren't they mentioned? Because they do so badly. Here's a funny story. I was having a meeting with a young Danish journalist I know who used to live in New York, and now she's back in Denmark. She was making a case for the Danish approach in terms of a welfare state. And I said to her, but what about all those other countries like Portugal, Spain, Greece, and Italy? Don't they do the same thing? And don't they have lower standards of living? Don't they have problems? And the way she responded was simply to say, but those are southern peoples. Those are southern peoples. Well, I responded, of course, by saying, well, my dear, our problem is that in the U.S., we have a lot of so-called southern peoples too. And so it's much more likely that if we tried what you're doing, we would end up like those countries rather than like Sweden, Denmark, and Norway, where you have this very high-class culture. You know, the old jokey test, which is you leave a wallet with a lot of money in it, and then does it get returned? You know, in the Scandinavian countries, all the wallets get returned. You know, you have an address in the wallet, but in these other countries, the wallets don't get returned. You know, so that's a difference in terms of honesty of culture. Now, in fact, there's no question that the Scandinavians also have a problem with their welfare state, but we needn't get into that. My point is that Europe in general is a test case for the Scandinavian model. And the term eurosclerosis was invented years ago to fit with the problems that the European countries face. And so that's my main point about that. And it does segue into another significant point that has to do with a number that was dug up relatively recently by John Early, who is a former assistant commissioner at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, having to do with welfare dependency. And it appears in this book called The Myth of American Inequality. I wrote John Early to get a complete backup on the number. And it goes this way. Looking at the poorest one-fifth of the population, the poorest one-fifth of the population, in 1967, two-thirds of those eligible to have jobs, age-eligible basically, had jobs. Two-thirds. Cut to 2017, where the job market was flourishing, and that had collapsed to one-third. One-third of those eligible to have jobs had jobs. So it went from two-thirds to one-third. And as Early and his colleagues point out, The only possible explanation is not the job market, because the 2017 job market had an abundance of jobs. It's really that the welfare state expanded fourfold in real terms over this period. That when the government creates a welfare state, it creates a culture of dependency. There's no real stake in getting people, giving people the so-called hand and not a handout. And so that's what's happened. These people are trapped in poverty, partly because of the so-called fiscal cliff, and the fiscal cliff being that once you start earning your first dollar after you receive welfare benefits, it costs you almost like more than a dollar in benefits. So there's no stake on the part of the government to get people out of poverty. There's, in fact, a stake on the part of the bureaucracy to keep people in poverty, keep people on the dole, because that's how they do their business. So again, I start with, in that case, in the most contentious part of making a case to a progressive, how are you going to help the poor? Aren't there going to be people who have difficulty making it on their own? And the answer is given in part by our colleague, Gerard Casey, whom you had on the show. I think I prompted you to have him on an essay he wrote called Let the Poor Starve, A Libertarian Approach to Welfare. As he wrote, there was social welfare before the welfare state got into the welfare business. So my point then is that if indeed there are people who have difficulty making it on their own in a free market, the free market can best handle it. If you give it to government, government will create dependency. If you give it to the free market, then the free market has a much better chance of helping these people in the appropriate way. So that's my main point there, Tom. Any comments, any criticisms?
Well, I like all that, no doubt about it. So I nothing I would take out. I also like the point that Johan Norberg makes, where he tells the old joke about how do you get yourself a small fortune? Answer, you start with a large fortune and you whittle it away.
And yes.
And so he says that the analogy with Sweden is that in the 19th and early 20th centuries, it was a much more free marketplace. So it could build up a lot of wealth that it could then spend on whatever these social welfare programs and stuff. So even in 1950, tax revenues in Sweden were still only around 21% of GDP. So it was over the next few decades that you get to see the much higher taxes coming in. And then, you know, then you do see a little bit of a more of a slowdown. But the wealth to do it came about in the first place because they had a market economy that could generate all this. I mean, you couldn't establish a welfare state like that in a poor country that was starting off with nothing. So that's a factor.
Well, that's basically a good point. You know, I would have to add to Johan's point that as much as you might have a free market in 1950 or 1960, Argentina, for example, and other countries can prove that, and of course, Venezuela can prove that it's not that hard for a destructive government to wreck the free market that they inherited. And so there is a certain, was it the president of Denmark or the mayor who protested when Bernie Sanders said they're socialists?
You know, right.
They do make efforts, and they did reform, they do make efforts to retain their free market. So I would caution and say that just because you have a free market in 1950 doesn't mean you can't get some strongman dictators and lunatics to destroy it in a matter of 10 or 20 years.
Yeah, so, no, the point was that as recently as 1950, they were still not unusually odd in the amount of, you know, the percentage of GDP going to taxes. And then you get all this happening.
I would say that they would have been better off had they just remained free market.
Yes, yeah, of course.
Again, of course, because they do have a culture. Although, I mean, there still are plenty of scandals. I gather what in Sweden in particular, it is possible to continue to go to college on the government's dole, and clearly a lot of people are taking advantage of it. There are a lot of abuses. I guess they have not created a culture of dependency, which is what's happened in this country. And indeed, that is what's happened in those so-called southern countries that also practice the Scandinavian model. And so we're cherry-picking that extremely self-reliant cultures in the case of the Scandinavians and using that as a case study to show that the U.S. should follow their example. And it's bound to be a failure. It already is a failure. We have people like Charles Murray who's written, Charles Murray, of course, wrote Losing Ground, which is about the culture of dependency, throwing up their hands and saying there's really no solution. Although, ironically, in the late 1990s under Bill Clinton, with the influence of the U.S., the Contract for America, was beginning to get people off that dependency, but then that got scuttled by the early aughts. And so, again, that's the weak underbelly, you might say, well, at least one of them, of our case to the progressives. And we only ask them to say that, again, the generosity of people in a rich capitalist society is extreme. But in a rich capitalist society, they want people, just like the Mormons, by the way. Murray Rothbard, as a matter of fact, wrote about the Mormon effort, welfare effort among their Mormon members. I remember asking Mark Skousen, who's a Mormon, our favorite Mormon, libertarian, whether Murray had gotten that from him. He said, no, Murray wrote that before he met me. And for New Liberty, he writes about the program that I know Mark and his wife, Joanne, are very active in, the Mormon Church, to people who have difficulty coping, how they get them on their feet, help them get a job. That's the way in which the free market would deal with this particular problem. There will be people who always have trouble coping. Yeah.
Right. In parentheses, I would add, well, just one more thing about the Swedes. It's like with COVID, no matter what, let's say, East Asian countries did, whether they locked down or they didn't, or they contact traced or they didn't, or whatever, they seem to get a pretty good outcome no matter what, oddly enough, you know, for whatever reason. And likewise, Swedes seem to get a pretty good outcome wherever they go. Swedes in the U.S., where there's even less of a welfare state, they wind up with incomes that are over 50% higher than their counterparts back in Sweden. Yeah. So whatever, they roll with the punches no matter where they are, for whatever reason.
Yeah. And of course, since you mentioned COVID, Tom, I can't help pointing out that you and I and others who talk about the problems of the lockdowns are now champions of Sweden because they kept their heads and they confessed to initial mistakes, but then they abrogated the lockdowns. And of course, so we end up, ironically, using the example of Sweden more often than the left does that these days.
Yeah, no kidding.
Which is kind of funny.
My next is
the standard one. You wrote an excellent chapter, which I have, because I picked up 33 questions about him. I still think it's a good time. You were great to ask. And of course, you've got a chapter on worker wages. Look, the main thing, of course, to teach progressives is how an expanding capitalism does benefit the broad masses of people, how capitalist investment does. And I was refreshed by finding that you were frequently quoting our pal George Riesman in that particular chapter. Maybe you forgot that. And I've gotten into this on your show before, Tom, but I want to spend a minute on it. You didn't quote this line, George's great rhyme about worker need and employer greed. And he points out that workers need a job, they can't wait, employers are greedy, why should they pay any more than they have to? They want to pay as little as possible, hence the worker is exploited. He uses an example of, you've got a car, you're moving to the middle of Manhattan, you can't afford to garage it, and you've got to sell it. So you've got a need to sell it, just like a worker has a need for a job, and you've got greedy buyers who want to pay as little as possible, and yet, you can sell it on the free market and you can get a decent price for it.
Yeah, even though, just as with the worker who supposedly can't wait, as Riesman says in the example of the car, you might be in such despair to get rid of this car that you would actually be willing to pay someone to take it off your hands. But yet, your willingness to pay someone to take it off your hands, doesn't determine what the price is.
That's right.
There are other factors that determine the price. So you won't have to pay someone, chances are, to take it off your hands.
And also, I should add that there is a myth, apparently, that if you work for Chipotle and you go four blocks away and you apply for a better job at Burger King, the Burger King people have you on a list that they're not going to hire you because you were once working for Chipotle. The fact of the matter is that the non-compete clauses, this non-compete, which high-priced workers do sign. And as Don Boudreau, by the way, points out, that if you sign a non-compete clause, you're usually doing it because they're going to pay you more. Non-compete means that you're going to restrict the employment contracts of all kinds. If you sign on to a period of play, you have to be bought out of that contract. But the idea that the hundreds and hundreds of employers all over any city can possibly keep databases, or that they're not bidding for your labor, is just ridiculous. There's no evidence for it. I'm speaking especially then about the broad masses of people. So that's the other part of it. But I also, the other card I play, and here's where Tom DiLorenzo becomes relevant indirectly, but the card I play is to look at the period from 1870 to the late 1920s, nearly 60 years, where we have pretty good records about standards of living, and where there was basically no meaningful intervention in the labor markets on the part of government. No support of labor unions until the 1930s, until Roosevelt came in. I don't know, there was like a here and there a minimum wage, but basically no real rules and regs governing labor. And on top of that, millions of immigrants pouring into the country seeking jobs. And yet, we don't have to look at actual calculations of wages. We just have to look at the standard of living of the broad masses of people from 1870 to the mid-1920s and say, well, where did all that improvement come from? How did it all happen? Well, it happened because labor did not need labor unions at that point. And they never did need labor unions. Labor unions actually create more problems, but that's another theoretical issue. The point is that all of those horrific times that progressives point to are really based on the fact that we were all a lot poorer in those days. So, of course, people worked long hours, but the work week shortened considerably by the mid-20s. Working conditions improved. All of those things happened in a naturally expanding economy. I mentioned Tom DiLorenzo because occasionally I hear, well, but the government is still very active in antitrust. And Tom, I guess he's the one who's done pioneering work showing that the very companies that were targeted as abusing their market power, and the abuse of market power essentially has to consist of constricting output so they keep the price high, they were doing the exact reverse, as Tom DiLorenzo pointed out. So right from the get-go, the entire effort on the part of the government where that's the claim, the government was doing real good for us by disciplining those monopolists, as Tom pointed out, they were disciplining the wrong people, because in those days, as Tom points out, by actually digging into the numbers, those very companies that were being targeted by antitrust were, in fact, expanding output faster than the economy was growing. And so that's the main point. We have theory and we have history on our side to demonstrate that the broad masses of people benefit vastly under capitalism. And then what are we left with? Well, we're left with Scandinavia, where Scandinavians do better in the U.S. And then we're left with comparing East Germany to West Germany, North Korea to South Korea. So again, if you want to do good for them, then you need capitalism. Any comments from you, or should I go on to the next point? Yeah.
Well, I obviously have very much in agreement with you. There's some good stats, but I take, you might have actually found some of them in 33 questions that I take from a book called Myths of Rich and Poor.
Yeah, 20 years
old, because that looks at products over time and the amount of purchasing power or the amount of labor you have to put in to earn the purchasing power to buy these products, and it's consistently downward. Now, of course, right now we're going through this inflationary period where you have to work a little bit, you know, maybe you do have to work a little bit more to buy bacon and eggs than you did before, but that's not a market phenomenon.
Well, no, it isn't, although, again, I wanted to avoid that. I do think that most people are doing a little bit better even with the inflation and with the price. But yeah, it's funny that when I spoke to Rob Burns, Paul Krugman talked about how Donald Trump goes around saying that bacon is 5 times more expensive than it ever was. And Krugman, and he said, he's fooling people into thinking bacon is 5 times more expensive when it's only 18% more expensive. And it's kind of funny. But that aside, I do think that people are coping better. They're coping. And part of my point, yes, we have a capitalist system, but, you know, by the way, I was refreshed hearing David Stockman echo my point. You had David on, and I've had problems with David here and there, so you know he had me on with him once, but David said that as much as he indicts our system, and as much as he might associate himself with my calling it a capitalist system, the fact is we do still have Walmart, we still have Amazon, we still do have a fair amount of entrepreneurial energy in this economy. And so it's not really such a hopeless situation. It's amazing how much people are able to cope and how much businesses are able to cope. But that's a digression. I wanted to go back to that earlier period, you know, because people said, well, we've got labor unions on strike, so that's benefiting. I wanted to go to the back to that earlier period of supposed labor horrors when we didn't have any, when labor union representation on the private sector from 1870 up to the early 30s was pretty minor. So you really can't, there were strikes, there were some labor union issues, but basically their share of the private market was in the single digits versus one third of the private sector was labor union in the early 1950s into the early 60s. And so they can point out, you know, they can get into those arguments. But I like to cite that earlier period. And indeed, going back to your point, just to affirm it, the idea of talking about actual breaking through the price indexes and the salaries and all the rest of it, and just talking about what did it mean to support a family of four in 1960? What kind of standard of living were you used to then? And what kind of standard of living do we take for granted today in terms of actual goods and services? And I think that's also an important point to make, that certainly there have been vast advances, too expensive to fly, too expensive to make a long-distance phone call, no air conditioning, black and white TV, all of those other things, and much smaller homes. And so that's another issue. But I guess I want to, in the time remaining, I want to talk about the other big soft underbelly, and where I guess the most I can say is that there's an open question, and that has to do with inequality. Now, I've heard you say a number of times, Tom, echoing my own sentiment, that it just doesn't keep me up nights to care about how rich Jeff Bezos is or whether, you know, but the only thing that I think the rich people have on us is they've got private planes and the government makes it very hard for us to fly these days. And then the dominance of the government in the medical care system is a little bit of a problem. So rich people have concierge service, but I don't necessarily envy them their big house and all this. Apart from that, I basically would be very happy living in a society in which we're all benefiting from economic growth, but I'm not the least bit interested in keeping track about whether Tom Woods is richer than I am. I'm just happy for you that you seem to be, Tom, and I don't care otherwise about. And as you've said, it's difficult for you to get too exercised about how well rich people live. It's just a question of how well do most of us live? How well do I live? And I have a few complaints, just like you have. So you agree with me there, Tom, right? So we're not...
Yeah. So you could make these theoretical claims, but knowing Gene Epstein and his desire for being complete on everything, you want to also look empirically at the question so as to hit this progressive concern?
Well, yeah. No, indeed. Obviously, Tom, this got to discipline ourselves. And obviously, we're inundated with all these arguments that our democracy is going to hell because of inequality and all the rest. I mean, it's everywhere, you know. And obviously, in Sweden, I'm sure they have a war. And Thomas Sowell has written about this over and over again, that if you have two kids in the same household and they're not equal in terms of their ability to make money, how can you expect equality generally? Of course, Sowell is pretty much in line with us. He just cares about everybody doing better and not making invidious comparisons about who's doing better than who's fabulously rich and who isn't. We do know the vast fortunes that people make are 90%, they either are given to charity or they're invested in something productive. And that actually segues into one point I'll make, which is that the distribution of consumer spending, of what we spend on consumption, is much narrower than the distribution of income, because the rich, again, of course, partly in this society, they spend it on taxes. But I do at least want to make the point about inequality that it's not inconceivable that a flourishing capitalist economy could have a narrower distribution, you may use that term, narrower income share than the kind of society we have now. We have many, many policies that exacerbate inequality. We have restrictive licensure, which has gone through the roof. And I put the restrictive licensure being that you can't become a manicurist or an assistant in a funeral home unless you gone through a course or passed some kind of test. And it's all government-sponsored in order to protect the guild system, to make it more difficult for people of limited means, especially, to find better jobs. I would go further with Milton Friedman, by the way, and say there should be no restrictive licensure in any field, including law and medicine. We have a vast subsidies for college, which just simply makes it more, which teaches kids nothing and makes it more and more difficult for people of limited means to pursue careers. In Europe, in particular, by the way, in most European countries, you can apply to medical school from right out of high school. You don't have to go to college first. So to make it more and more difficult for people of limited means to pursue these careers is part of what government does to foster inequality. And then we have this more subtle problem of the Federal Reserve, of the real trickle down, which is that the Federal Reserve inflates the money supply, and most of that money goes initially to the rich. And I mean, David Stockman, by the way, has recently cited Federal Reserve numbers showing that inequality of wealth has been fostered recently by the vast expansion of money by the Federal Reserve. So I'm saying that we would certainly want to get rid of those policies that interfere with the free market, that foster inequality, and then it would be difficult to say. I mean, the other broader point to make is that global inequality, up to the point where the Economic Freedom Index was rising through 2019, most of those years up through 2019 until 2020, the Economic Freedom Index, the five criteria of the degree to which you have free market, global inequality was declining because more and more countries were turning to economic freedom and raising their standard of living. So again, I only want to say that we can't guarantee a greater equality of income distribution in a free market economy, but we can say, not just, of course, the broad masses of people would vastly benefit, we can also say that it's difficult to predict where we would end up once we get rid of all the ways in which the government makes it easier for rich people to get richer. I mean, another particular point is that price inflation hurts people of limited means, but usually people who have some means, the richer people, are invested in the stock market, and the stock market keeps ahead of inflation. And so there are all kinds of subtle ways in which government policy fosters inequality. And so we really don't know what would happen in a free market. We may have greater equality of income in a free market than we do under the so-called mixed economy system that we have today.
Hey, everybody, a quick message from our friends at Policy Genius, who sponsor this here program. Here we are at the beginning of a new year, fresh new year, ready to do brand new things we haven't done before. We're full of ambition and confidence, and one of those things you should be doing is something Old Woods here has been urging you to do, and that is finding the right life insurance to protect your family with Policy Genius. You get life insurance today, you have peace of mind throughout 2024 and beyond, so that if, heaven forbid, anything were to happen to you, your family could cover their expenses while getting back on their feet. And Policy Genius will help you do that. I have tremendous peace of mind because my family is fully provided for with my life insurance policy, and it's much less expensive than you think. As a matter of fact, with Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 per year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams. Even if you already have a life insurance policy through work, it may not offer enough protection for your family's needs, and it may not follow you if you leave your job. Policy Genius knows how valuable your time is, so with just a few clicks, you'll be comparing quotes from top insurers and finding your lowest price. They have thousands of five-star reviews on Google and Trustpilot, and no wonder. Save time and money and give your family a financial safety net with Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com or click the link in the description or on the show notes page to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's policygenius.com. You talk about global inequality. I just think about arguments that I've made over the years that haven't changed because no one's ever shown me what's wrong with them. But, you know, I like Mises' argument about inequality, that if we look back far in, you know, say centuries backwards in history, and we look at the difference between rich and poor, it's a much, much more significant gap, you know, because I have no shoes and I'm barely clinging to existence. And your claim to fame is that you're riding around in a coach.
Yeah.
And you're living a life, you know, you're probably somewhat cleaner. In other words, you have a means of transportation. I don't even have shoes to walk with.
Yeah.
Whereas now, the rich person and I both have a car, which would have been a miracle to everybody in those days. And I can fly. He has his own plane. I have to use somebody else's plane. And when you put it that way, it sounds like a little unreasonable to be that upset. Wait a minute. You mean you have to use somebody else's plane that flies you through the air, which would have been inconceivable to everyone?
I know the government force, I think the airport security is all, of course, that's the big pain in the butt to us all that the government does to us. But I take you, matter of fact, Tom, thank you for that important point. Here, I forgot it altogether. It's just as you say. I mean, the Maasai warrior owns the same smartphone that Bill Gates owns. And that, in fact, I know that, I guess Don Boudreau has picked up on this point considerably. And I didn't even realize it originated with Mises, that indeed, if you actually look at distribution of goods and services in a rising economy, the gap really narrows considerably. The difference between rich and poor becomes increasingly difficult to recognize. Absolutely.
And incidentally, specifically to people who say that I'm obligated to, you know, because let's say I'm doing better than other people, so I should have to disgorge some of my holdings, let's say, to the less fortunate, quote-unquote. Yeah. I hate the use of the word fortunate in that context.
Yeah, but,
so my response to that has very often been, now I think the numbers are probably a little bit different. Now, so let's say, let's give them the benefit of the doubt, let's say $30,000 a year puts you roughly in the top 1% or 2% of all income earners all over the world. So now all of a sudden you should, by the same logic, have to yield a good chunk of what you have to all those people. But yet, something tells me you're not going to do it. So you're telling me that you either have no principles, or your principle is other people should make sacrifices, but when it comes to be my turn, I'll find some excuse not to.
Well, usually the sacrifice is in terms of paying more taxes to the government, which is not the best way to spend your money. But that is interesting. You were the one who turned me on to that book by John Rawls, the Harvard philosopher, who's become most, of course, notorious, most famous for his argument about a distribution of income. And as you pointed out, the irony about John Rawls is that he was not a redistributionist globally. He thought that it was okay for rich countries to keep their money in poor countries to muddle through. I think I have that right. And you're absolutely, although, see, this is the irony of what you say is that it's all true. Although the fine point I would add is that usually when these people talk, they really mean that it should be given to the government. But you're absolutely right, of course, that all of us, pretty much all of us in this economy, if we're going to preach to others about being philanthropic, globally, almost all of us have the same moral obligation to be philanthropic. I gather that Peter Singer, who's very much for animal rights, actually does push that argument, although I don't know to what extent he actually does it himself, that indeed we have an obligation. All of us, he makes that very point that you are making, and he takes it seriously, that all of us, including the $30,000 a year people, have an obligation to be philanthropic. But with that said, here's a funny statistic, as though it's a statistical law, that if you ever want to estimate how much official philanthropy is being declared in the U.S. economy, most of the time, if you just take 2% of nominal gross domestic product, then that gives you the figure, so that the figure now is $450 billion that is given away in this economy, U.S. economy, even today, with everybody's imagining that the government is pretty much taking care of those in need. But the philanthropic dollar really is pretty generous, and certainly it would help those in need. Philanthropic dollar, of course, flocks to medical care, to scientific research, and in fact, most of us, most people, I mean, I happen to know personally, Tom, that you have a philanthropic urge. You donated a very nice sum of money at one point to my solo forum. I know you donate to others as well, and you're not as rich as Bezos. And so we do all have that urge to help others without being coerced into doing it. And of course, the famous fortunes, so many of the famous fortunes are devoted to philanthropy. So that urge exists in any case. And that's part of my point. I have some other points to make, Tom, but I don't know if we're how much more time.
Oh my gosh. All right. Okay. I think because of the outsized amount of time we spent on the initial banter, I think to give people the amount of content that they need to survive on, we can dive into one more Gene Epstein point.
Oh, just one more.
Okay. We're going to pick the best one you have.
Oh, God. An easy one, I guess, Tom, would be just about, you know, discrimination against minorities. And that obviously the point that was originally made by Gary Becker, the Nobel Prize winner, and then picked up most eloquently by Thomas Sowell, is that a market economy punishes bigotry, makes it very costly to be a bigot. I came across a recent estimate from the Economic Policy Institute. They're still on that happy horse. They said that women get paid 22% less than men, and we've got to do something about it. So then I tweeted, picking up actually on Thomas Sowell's example, doing the numbers, I said, well, if women are paid 78% of what men are paid for doing the same exact work, who would hire any men? You could hire, do the math, you can get 13 women for every 10 men for the same price. And that was the point that Thomas Sowell made, that all those greedy profit-maximizing capitalists wouldn't hire any men. Only even the worst male chauvinists would be driven out of business. And the reason why I cite Sowell is that he dug into two elements of history. He found that under apartheid, in the Union of South Africa, when it was under an apartheid system, capitalists were blatantly breaking the law against hiring blacks because it was costing too much not to do so. And he also found that under Jim Crow in the South in the late 1800s, the same thing was happening. Capitalists were violating the Jim Crow laws. And so again, but when it comes to the government, when Woodrow Wilson fired all the black employees from the civil service, then what difference did it make? There was no cost to him to do so. And so, I was raised, by the way, I have a communist background. My mother was and my mother thought that, you know, capitalism fosters racism and bigotry. And in fact, it does exactly the reverse. And of course, that's part of the reason why Sowell, in particular, Thomas Sowell, black economist, who should be familiar to regular listeners of your show, points out, as do others, that black economic progress was very, very substantial and faster, in fact, prior to the advent of the civil rights laws than afterwards. And that, I get into a touchy subject, affirmative action can cause racism because it will mean that there will be a certain knee-jerk attitude that somebody, a black person, or in fact, I experienced this on Wall Street years ago with women who were getting promoted, who were not that competent at their jobs. There was this now a sort of reverse racism, the cynicism that they were getting it only because they were being favored by affirmative action. So it causes racist resentment, government role in this. I guess that's a vast subject to touch on. Let me just again return to emphasize that obviously capitalism cannot obliterate bigotry, but it can certainly exact a very huge cost from any capitalist who practices bigoted hiring.
Gene, why don't we give people the link? I should have thought to look this up, but I'm going to do it right now. I just found it. If you would like to see Gene throw all this together and be with a bunch of like-minded people, you can attend the Libertarian Party Convention of Florida, or the Florida State Party Convention. The website is LPF, so that's Libertarian Party of Florida. That's not hard to remember. LPFCon.org. LPFCon.org is the website. And it's coming right up. And we say this Saturday, that's a little inside info because people don't know when we're talking about. We mean Saturday, January 20th, 2024.
Let me make just one more brief assertion. Capitalism simply means private ownership of the means of production. Full stop. If the workers are the ones who own the company, that's also capitalism. And so many of my socialist friends want workers to own their own company, very easily achievable under capital. If it could be done in Spain with the Mondragon company that the socialists keep touting in a much poorer country, it can be done here if workers want it. So you can also have worker ownership under capitalism. That's just my final assertion without elaborating on that too much. Yeah.
Because they can always watch your debate with Ben Burgess if they want to.
With Ben Burgess, well, actually, the one with Richard Wolff has gone through is shot through 6.4 million views. And I can't believe it. With Rick Wolff, Ben Burgess one got 100,000. With Rick Wolff, I've gotten 6.4 million and it keeps rising. And so I credit him. And so I make that point with him. So that's the popular one you should flock to. Me versus Richard Wolff about socialism versus capitalism, which I made that point and put me up to 6.5 million views.
That is tremendous, Gene. That is tremendous. You have surpassed Woods by many times over. All right, so lpfcon.org.
I'm 79 and you're only 51, so you've got
I have some time. I'll need it. So lpfcon.org is the website for that. And also, yes?
Yes, go on. Yeah, no, this is my cell phone. Yeah.
I'm the host here. Give me a chance. I'll do it.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
TheSohoForum.org is where to go to find out about all the very interesting debates Gene has coming up and how you can attend them either in person or virtually. So does that cover it?
Yes, it does. Yes.
Okay. So I'll have these links also on the show notes page, which is tomwoods.com/2440. Gene, do you have a final word?
Well, Terence Keeley, especially, who was on the Tom Woods show, listen to that interview, and then you'll be fascinated to see Terence Keeley in the flesh in New York defending his resolution about basic research under capitalism versus whether the government has to finance it. That's January
9th. I think Terence Keeley's episode with me is one of the best Tom Woods show episodes ever.
Yes, so. It was, definitely. And Terence Keeley going on stage to defend his views against a very intelligent critic is going to be just as good.
I can't wait. Yeah, I mean, that I can't be in person for, but I will be in person watching the one you're doing in February. So anyway, thesohoforum.org is where to go, everybody. And with that, thank you very much, as always, to our good friend Gene Epstein. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.